Well, that's a weekend. Picking up Bezat Hashem. You know, we have a drop of Sephardi influence in our family. So as soon as we even make the word break up for Havdalah, we laugh. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a contrived laugh, and we're going to give but it is that's the first moment of the week. And you want to start the week with Simcha. So you want to invest that very first moment with Simcha. So really, these are still the first moments of the week. We should invest them in Hashem, growing and learning. So it's so nice to see you here. I'm sure everyone wasn't able to finish up everything before you scooted out the door, but it's so nice to see you. My kitchen's clean.
I don't know. But yours is, so that's nice.
Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about growing ourselves through growing our children. So let's just, I did learn that written Torah you're supposed to actually read from instead of quote straight up, so I just brought it to quote. Let's just talk about who our most important child is. Right, so it says in Noach, Ela Toldot Noach, these are the generations of Noach, these are his children. Who are they? Right, what says next? That's right. The next word is not his children. These are the generations of Noach. Noach. Right? That's what the pasuk says. So we learn from that the most important child that we raise is ourselves. So of course we need to raise our children too, and we'll talk about how they go together. But our primary responsibility is to raise ourselves. And that's the only child that we have constant access to and actually any hope of success with. Because turns out our children are Baalei Bechira, right? So the Boston Rebbe said that the greatest gift that God gave to mankind is free will. And unfortunately, he gave that gift to our children as well. So it turns out we get to pick, and so do they. So the only one whose choices we have control over are our own. So that's the only one we're held 100% responsible for, and our children we can invest in, and then they take it from there. So we'll go back and forth talking about raising ourselves and raising our children. Okay. So there's a nice quote that I like in terms of thinking about who we are. So we'll start with that. Who we are is God's gift to us. And what we make of ourselves is our gift to God. So how we come into the world is not up to us. Our nature, our nurture, we don't get to pick that. Right? We come into the world with all these circumstances, absolutely unique circumstances for each one of us. And then, after that, our free will kicks in. So we're not more nature, more nurture, that whole controversy that we learned about in college. We're influenced by our nature. We're influenced by our nurture, each person to a different extent, and who we are. It's our choice. We choose ourselves into who we are today. It's choice after choice after choice after choice. Maybe our choices started with where Hashem put us in the world, nature and nurture. But after that, it's our choice to become who we're going to become. It's completely up to us. So that's an important concept. We are here to make those choices, to grow ourselves. So the question is, how do we grow ourselves? So there's a fascinating explanation from Hirsch on the idea of gadol hametzuva. Right? What's more important? What's the better thing to do? Is it better to raise children because you like to raise children, because you want to raise children, because you want to invest in the next generation, or because you're commanded by God to raise children? Is it better to give tzedakah because you're a nice person and you want to share, or because you're commanded by God to give tzedakah? What's the better thing? That you want to do it, that you're commanded to do it. Mm-hmm. Any other votes?
I think it's both. I think
both.
If you're doing anything with Hashem over you, it just makes it more spiritual, it makes it more painful than if you're doing it yourself. Like whether it's something in your head, with your children, if God's hand is in it, so with that choice, I think it's automatically more meaningful.
So it's interesting because there really is discussion about it. It actually comes down to it's better if you're commanded. Right? That's the answer. It's greater. The one who's commanded is greater than the one who's not commanded. Right? Doing it because you're commanded is greater than that. Why? So the typical explanation, I like your explanation, I'll put that in as number two. Right? So the number two explanation, anything that God has his hand in, that's better. Okay? The first explanation that our sages often share is that Once you're commanded, it's harder, right? It's harder. You have to get to hurry. You don't feel like doing it, right? So you give tzedakah, you see somebody, they need it, you want to share, you want to buy an MP3 player for a child that's sick. How nice is that? You feel terrific, right? You fill it with Jewish music, and you know that they're going to feel better, and you feel so good that you gave that way. But when somebody says, you have to, now you're thinking, really, $35? I can do a lot with $35. I'm not really sure I want to do that with my $35, right? You are a startup with all this needs. So the Yetzer Hara can get in the way. So it's harder to do it because you have to overcome that in order to accomplish the task. So Rav Hirsch gives a third explanation, which I like a lot, which is you become greater by doing the commandment. Gadol hametzuva. Not that the act is greater once it's commanded, but the person who does it is a greater person. Why? Because you're only as nice as you are. Right? So let's say you're going to give MP3 players. Let's say you're going to make challah. You can only do that to the edge of how nice you are or of how spiritual you are. That's as big as you are. You might be huge, but you have edges, right? And that's how big you are, or that's how big you are. What if you want to be bigger than that? You can't be bigger than you are unless you tap into something that's bigger than you. And that's the mitzvah system. Once you plug into Torah and mitzvahs, it's much bigger than any of us are. So if we want to increase our capacity, we can't do it on our own because we can only force ourselves to the edge of who we are. But once we're commanded, so then we can go past what we actually feel like doing. It's the only way we can get past our personal limitations. Gadol hametzuva. So it turns out none of us in this room are commanded with raising children. Because we're all female. Right? That's the guy's mitzvah. Prove or remove. You know, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That's all for guys. So, and really, it's interesting. The reason, I mean, we're the ones who are doing the lion's share of the work. How come it's their mitzvah? Is that really fair? Right? Okay. I personally think, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you could discuss it. One of the explanations I like a lot is it protects women. Men have the mitzvah, women have to be persuaded to do the mitzvah. Now, they don't have to be persuaded very hard. However, they have to trust the man enough to be willing to support him in his project. So he really has to extend to her the trustworthiness before she says, yes, I'll help you. I'll risk my life in getting pregnant and delivering your child, and I'll spend my life investing in your child. But first, convince me that you're worth it, right? So if we were commanded with it, we'd have to do it, whether or not we felt like it, whether or not we felt safe, right? But the Torah never commands us to put our life on the line as a mitzvah itself.
What about Chava being told it's our divine and all that stuff that wasn't given to a woman as her? Maybe the man has to officially populate the world, but one of the new trials in the world, isn't that Chava's curse that the woman's going to
have? Curse is different than mitzvah, right? A woman does not have to have children. It's not her obligation. A woman could choose
not to.
A woman can choose not to marry, and a woman could choose to marry and not have children. That's up to her, right? The man is required to marry, and the man is required to have children. So he has to first convince her that he's safe enough for her to want to participate in helping him with his mitzvah. Not that she doesn't get a lot of schus for doing what she's doing, but it's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is his. I think one reason is to protect her so that she doesn't have to, chase him and put her life on the line for some. It really is, you're putting your life on the line to raise children. So to have children. Anyway, that's a parenthetical concept here, that's not the main focus, okay? So what I want to focus on is stretching ourselves through this process, right? So we're establishing from the beginning the most important child that we raise is ourselves, and the way that we expand ourselves, the way that we transform ourselves, that we transcend our nature and our nurture is through tapping into the mitzvah system. Then we can definitely see that in raising children, there are a lot of mitzvahs that we're engaged in. Chesed. And teaching them how to be in the Torah pathway, kavod av v'em, all these mitzvahs that we teach our children, and all the practice that we do on expanding ourselves through raising them. So it really pushes us far past where we ever thought we would go. I remember with my first daughter. She's 28 now. We lived in Long Beach, Long Island at the time when she was born. And I took her out for walks on the boardwalk, and we came back from the boardwalk one time, and I cut a slice of watermelon to share with her. Back in those days, there used to be seeds in watermelon. So the seeds, of course, you don't want to give to somebody who's just learning how to eat. And also the center of the watermelon was the sweetest, juiciest part, the best. Right? And then the seeds was the annoying, less sweet part of the watermelon. So of course, as a mother, I cut off the top, put it on her tray, and cut it into little pieces. And then I stood there looking at myself thinking, what did I just do? Look what I did. Like, it was an automatic thing. I gave her the best. You know, like, that's the part I want. I don't really want the part that's left on my plate. I want that. But I gave it to her. You know, of course that's what I did. She's my baby. She gets the best and the easiest and the yummiest because she's the child. So you work on sublimating yourself and sublimating yourself, mm-hmm. or actualizing yourself and actualizing yourself, becoming a giver in every single act that you do. I remember it was very difficult getting up for little children. I'm sure you all remember those days, right? Waking up at night and nursing. And I had 6 kids in 7.5 years, and the middle 2 were twins. So, and I used to wake up at night and nurse the twins and think, thank God I have twins, and thank God I don't have triplets. Just thinking about nursing 3, you know. I had a 4-year-old and a hyperactive 3-year-old and baby twins. And at that time, I was learning with Tili Yeager, and we learned the pasuk from Eshet Chayil, Loif Beva Laila Neira. Her light doesn't go out at night. So on a pshat level, she was saying that it was part of the housewife's work to keep the embers alive at night so that you could rekindle the fire in the morning. And it was a tricky thing. You didn't want to waste fuel. Right, because fuel was difficult to obtain. So you wanted to have just a little ember, because there weren't matches either. So you couldn't strike a match to light a new fire to make breakfast. But you didn't want to waste a lot of fuel overnight to keep the fire going. So you had to figure out just the right amount of fuel to keep it, so that, and bank it just right, so your light wouldn't go out at night. Right, so a good woman's light doesn't go out at night. It'd be embarrassing to have to go next door to get the flame to start breakfast. So she said, but metaphorically what it means is that a woman is up all night tending to her home and taking care of things. Her light doesn't go out. She doesn't turn off the lights at night. She's constantly doing things for the family. And I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I'm up all night nursing. I don't have enough energy to be up all night taking care of my family. And I thought, wait a second, that's what nursing is. I was too tired to even realize that that's what I was doing, is being up all night taking care of my family. And then on a deeper level, what that means is that in the night of our life, in the dark times when we can't see clearly, and it feels heavy and we're a little bit lost, our light still doesn't go out. The light of the moon, the light of the era, that when it's hard, dark times, the light still stays lit. So I was busy with my twins, thinking about these things and trying to grow and imagine what it would be like when they're grown up. And all these kids around, sometimes it was like so surreal. You know, you get married, you have a bunch of kids, and then you feel like, I felt like anyway, sometimes I was a babysitter. Like soon somebody's going to come and pay me a lot of money for taking care of these kids for so long. And they'll take them all away, and I'll get to like relax again, finally. But I reckon they're all mine. And I have to keep taking care of them and keep taking care of them. And sometimes it was frustrating. So I started to imagine, who am I raising? Who am I really responsible to? So I thought about babysitting, and I realized, really, I am just babysitting. But the adult that I'm babysitting for is not going to pay me, really, except hopefully in that house. But the adult that I'm babysitting for is hidden inside that child. And someday that adult is going to come and take away the child. Except for, unlike in a babysitting situation, that adult's going to know everything that I did. Everything. There's no hiding, right, from that adult. That adult is totally aware every single day of the babysitting exercise. So I tried, it helped me keep my cool, and it helped me keep my focus that I'm babysitting for that adult. And I just have to keep this child safe until that adult can take the child away. So that was part of how it worked. I tried to keep a focus on what am I trying to raise? I'm trying to raise independent children. So I have a lot of different things. I watch a lot of different parenting exercises, a lot of different parenting classes, especially with some ADD kids. And I took special classes for parents with ADD. When I signed up for special classes for parents of extremely difficult children, I did a read lots of books. Recently, a psychologist called me and said, do you have the book, The Explosive Child? I said, I have The Explosive Child, The Difficult Child, The Sad Child. I'm the misunderstood child. I'm raising sad children. I'm raising interesting children. I'm raising difficult children. I'm raising sensory children. I have a whole bookshelf of all kinds of stuff. So I wrote her the title. She sent me back and said, are you serious? I'm like, I'm serious. No, I'm making up titles here. I have a whole bookshelf. So it's funny, I learned from her husband, and I wanted a Shas to be able to look through them. We didn't have Shas. So I'm the learner in the family. I don't learn Gemara, but I like to look things up occasionally. So I spoke to her husband, and I said, I'm thinking about getting a Shas. What do you recommend in the under $500 range? He said, let me think about it. So I went back to him, he said, are you serious about that? And then I regretted it. I said, under $500, because I think that's a lot. I don't want something quite that much, because something I'm just going to look up once in a while. I said, yeah, I'm really serious about it. I said, that if it could be less than $500, like, that'd be better. He said, well, I have one that's a better price than that. I said, you do? He said, and he had a one from the 1860s. He said, you know that Shas on the top of my shelf in the study where we learn? I said, yeah. He said, well, I said, I'm ready to pass that on. If you'd like it, you could have that one. I was like, I like it. It's so beautiful. It's too old, really, to learn from. But it's great for looking up in. So I'm the right customer for that Shas. So he gave that to me. So he said, the only condition is you have to find a space for it. So I came home thinking, where am I going to put the Shas? It's really two bookshelves. It's so tall. And I looked at all the difficult children books, and I thought, they are going. I'm done. My last kid is out of high school. I don't need those books anymore. So I cleared off that whole shelf and called his wife, who's a psychologist. I said, do you need any books on children?
And I know you have Shas.
So then I apologized to him later, and I told him about the switcher. He said, oh, don't worry. My bookshelf space and her bookshelf space are completely separate. So, okay. So, from all the different classes and learning and things that I've been thinking about, so I understand that there are goals in raising children. Of course, there's lots of little goals. But really, my current nutshell goals for raising children are independent, healthy, and happy that comes from that. Not happy as a goal. Of course, we want our kids to be happy. But if you aim for happy, you can't accomplish it. But if you aim for independent and healthy, happiness hopefully will be a byproduct, but it's not up to parents to create happy, actually. That's something only a person can create for themselves. You can try to create the right environment for happiness to flow from, but you can't give happiness to anyone, right? But working towards independence, working towards healthy, that really is the goal of parenting. Okay, so those are the big things, and of course there's tons of little things under there. But independent really is the key. So where do we see that in Torah sources? So first of all, Rabbi Aredi has a very nice work on this, which I like a lot, so I'll share with you. So he talks about the roots of words being shared, and what can we learn from their connection. So if we have the word lihi gamel, to wean from nursing, so the lihi gamel has the gimel mem lamed root. You can also see that gimel mem lamed root in gemilut chasidim, gomel chasid, right? Giving acts of kindness, or doing good, giving good. And also in gamal, a camel. So how do you relate weaning and giving and camels, right? They have to be related, right? The way that I see it, I know we talk about shorashim in Hebrew, but for me, hubs and spokes works really well as an image. So if you think about a hub, and you put the shorish in the hub, and then different manifestations radiate from that hub, so you have the spokes. So then you have gamal, you have ligamal, you have gemilut chasidim, and whatever other gimel mem lamets come from that, all radiate from that. But they have to be connected because they're all into the same hub, right? So how do these connect? So he explains, really, that the goal of parenting is to create independence. How do you do that, right? So we look at a camel, a camel is a symbol of independence. They drink so much that then they can go into the desert and be independent of food and water sources. They are independent travelers because they've absorbed so much. So there's an independence based on absorbing. So what do? We start out the process by giving and giving and giving and giving so that they can absorb and absorb and absorb. But part of the giving process has to be weaning. Has to be the higamel to end the giving so that they can be agama. So you start with gomel, you get to the higamel, and the end hope is agama, somebody who's absorbed enough that they can move independently with that which they've absorbed. But if we don't wean them, then we risk them falling into a feminine trap, really. The letter Samech, which I think is the letter of the month of Kislev, but it's a letter, it's a feminine letter, so it's shaped like a hug, right? It's just a big circle, right? I don't have a source for this except for Tehillah, but that's where I learned it from, so I should ask her for the source. But the letter Samech is a circle, it's a feminine letter. So a hug is embracing. But if it's too tight or too long, it's smothering, right? So we want to create an environment of embrace, but then an environment of empowerment. And one of the classic mistakes in parenting is trying to keep a child and raise them so that they need you and they're dependent on you and not letting them go free. So it's a trick, and especially in our world, I just recently, unfortunately, my father-in-law just passed away, so I was sitting, I was with my husband and mother-in-law, and his siblings were sitting, she's in Manhattan, so I was there, I met a woman there who was telling me how, she's a therapist, but she did not care at all what she was saying, but she has three sons, and the kinds of wives she wants for her sons are orphans, or converts, or balshuvas, or people who have come with no family. That's what she wants. She wants her son to stay hers. And she's so clear about it. She only wants a wife that doesn't come with a family attached.
She wants any of it.
You're a therapist. You don't even hear what you're saying. How enmeshed you are with your children. Of course. And she's busy telling me how she still has one at home. Two have left and gone far away to college. I'm thinking, I wonder why. Try to create an environment where you will stay with me, and I want you, and you're mine, and I'm never letting you go, not ever. So with that in mind, I think it's important to think about it. So it is, we invest in them so much, and then the hardest thing is to let them go. Right? So I was davening for one of my children who was giving me many different opportunities to grow and learn through her. So I was saying Ashrei, but I was really focusing on Teyachet Tadech on the scale of Chayrat. So open up your hand, Hashem, and grant what I want, my Ratzon, right? But the second Teyach, which I like even better, is for when you're really tired of wanting it, or you don't even feel like wanting it. Or let's say your child doesn't want what you want them to want, right? So you can say, Teyachet Tadech on the scale of Chayrat. Ratzon, right? Please open up your hand and give ratzon to every living thing. Give them desire. Maybe they don't even want something. Maybe I don't necessarily want what I should want, or I'm tired of wanting it. Please give me just the desire for what I need to have desire for. But since I do have that little bit of Sephardi influence, so while I was saying the pasuk, I opened up my hand. Right? That's a Sephardi thing to do. But today I had to do that on a scalable chiron. So I was used to the first taich, first translation, and the second translation, but then I thought about a third way to understand it. As I opened my hand, I thought, look at this hand, open. It's Peteach HaTedecha. Don't say Peteach HaTedecha. Peteach HaTedecha. Hashem, please give to me with an open hand. Not with strings attached. That's not how I want it. I want it open, that you give me the gift and you allow me, I see how you allow me to make the choice of the gift that you give me. You give and you give and you give. Even if I mess it up, you give again. And you don't give with strings attached, you just give. That might be a hint into how I should be working with the teenager, older teenager, is to open up the hand instead of, you know, like it's on my terms. I'll give you, but only if you follow these rules. You know, so it's hard launching children and letting them take their sense of desire and do with your gifts what they want. And that's part of the process. So that, having that in mind, knowing that those days are coming or have come for some of you or are coming for others of you, I'll give you a parenting paradigm that I see. What I talk about, the difference between lobster parenting and human parenting. So what's the difference between a lobster and a human being? They're both tricks, right? So you can't eat either one.
Claws.
Claws, okay. Skeleton position. Okay, lobsters have skeletons on the outside and soft stuff on the inside. And we have skeletons on the inside and soft stuff on the outside. The skeleton provides the structure for the vulnerable material, right? So a lobster has all its vulnerable stuff on the inside protected by its structure on the outside. We have our vulnerable stuff on the outside supported by structure on the inside. So in just thinking about the physical differences, there is a parenting paradigm difference. Young children need to be parented like lobsters, right? All structure comes from the outside. They aren't capable of creating the structure that's necessary to protect them. But hopefully by the time we're adults, we're human beings with a structure on the inside, which leaves our vulnerable selves exposed. But as parents, our job is to switch the structure from externally provided to internally supportive. And that's really the job of, let's say, parenting from 7-ish to 14-ish, right? Well, you can stretch it in either direction, move those numbers around. But basically, from total structure, there has to be a flip to internal structure. Because if you haven't gotten the flip by a certain age, whatever, depends on your own kid, it could be 12, it could be 16, it's likely not later than 16. After that time, they can do whatever they want. And that can tell you whatever you want to hear, or tell you stuff you don't want to hear, but you can't control them, right? You lock them in the room, they can go out the window. You tell them they can't drive there, they can drive it. You tell them they can't spend the money, they can steal it from you. They can take your credit card, they can steal it from somebody. They can do whatever they want, or they can just earn it. They can do whatever they want. They can move out on their own, they can be emancipated, they can tell you that they don't want you to be part of their medical care. You can't force them to do anything after about 14 medically. So,
they can convert.
They can convert, for crying out loud. There could be 13 generations of Protestant pioneers, and they could just become Jewish in one day. That's why I definitely want to put into them, and I think I do appreciate the fact that my parents definitely wove into us independence and the ability to think critically and look at the situation around us and discern what was right and what we wanted to change and who we wanted to be in relationship with that situation. So it cost them, but I think in the end they won because they gained a daughter that's respectful and kind and contributing to the world and has a stable marriage and lots and lots of children, so I got them. Unhealthy children. Whatever. A big bouquet of children. So independence is what we want. In the Gemara, it talks about the three things that every parent is required to give to their child. Right? Do you know what they are? Or give to them. A livelihood. Teach them how to make a livelihood.
Swim.
Teach them how to swim. Get them married. Right? Married. Those are the three
commandments. That's the
submission. Right, right. It does say teach them to your children, but this is an interesting remark. Think about what is the thread that unites those three things. Teach them how to make a living, teach them how to swim, get them married.
Survival skills.
Independence. Teaching them how to swim, you might think that's just teaching them how to swim in the water, which it is. It's required. Mm-hmm. But really, it's teaching them how to swim in life. Right? How to swim.
Making it on their own.
Yeah. How do you swim? How can you become financially independent? How can you become relationship-wise independent? So I'm going to marry you off to somebody else. Right? Not off to me. But you will marry from somebody from another family and make your own and make your own choices. It's a scary thing for a parent to do. Right? And parnasat, that you should be able to function swimming in that world with that other person. And that is the parent's responsibility, is to create that level of independence. Of course, there's lots of things along the way. Shinantama Vinefa teaches words to your children. Sharpen these words in their mouths. It also means that. Shinantama is to sharpen also. Sharpen these words in their mouths. Make them there for them. Set the example. All that stuff is for sure there. But the overall goal is to launch them in an independent, and now I'll say healthy way. So independence is the must of parenting. Healthy is the, it would really be great, right? So healthy, there's a few different levels of healthy, right? There's emotional health, there's spiritual health, there's physical health, there's intellectual health. So I would say physical health is your body's healthy and you know how to keep it healthy, right? So you know enough about nutrition or exercise or sleep or whatever, you've been educated to that level, given whatever treatments you need to get to healthy if you're not healthy. And let's say somebody's not healthy, then learn how to deal with the not healthy and function that way in a healthy way as possible, right? So if somebody has diabetes, so you can't make them healthy, but you can help them understand how to deal with it, right? How to control their intake, how to control their exercise, how to control their medicines, how to be in touch with the doctor, give them independence in healthcare, all that stuff. But you can create that kind of health, right? Or facilitate that kind of health. It's not something you are totally in control, but hopefully you can give to them. Right? Other kinds of health. So intellectual health. I think intellectual health is really being educated enough to know how to get educated more and to desire to get educated more. Right? So you know enough to know what you know and what you don't know, and that you can know more and know how to find out more. Right? So we want to get them to that place in many different areas, but in general, in intellectual health. And then emotional health is emotional health in relationships with self and with others, so learning how to navigate relationships and learning how to navigate self. And then spiritual health, that's your relationship with Hashem, right, and how to navigate that. So we want them to be healthy in those areas. So I'd say independent, a must. Healthy in those areas, really great, highly desirable, that's really main. And then the hopeful is happy. That the happy should flow from real independence and health. Once somebody's achieved that, then happiness comes from functioning well in the world and knowing how to function well in the world. But again, happiness is not something we can aim for. It's a goal that we have. It's only a byproduct of those other things. Okay. That being said, let's talk about some tools that will help us grow and help the kids grow. So, I did have some challenging children, and one of them challenged me a lot. I remember. I learned also that these three things, what is a great person? So if I remember them now, ha'aluv ve'eno ne'alav, shomea chervato ve'eno mashiv, mekabel yisri ma'ava, ketzeit ha'shamash ve'gurato. Right, the one who's insulted and doesn't take insult. The one who hears their chervah, their embarrassment, their shame, something like that, and doesn't respond. And the one who receives suffering with love, they are like the sun shining in its zenith. So these are three positive qualities of somebody who's really worked out. We're not going to go fully into what that is, but I learned that. And then, maybe a year later, I'm trying to think, like, what is that to be insulted and not take insult, working on this concept? And certainly Hashem is depicted as somebody who's insulted and doesn't take insult. He gives us energy, he gives us breath, and with the breath and energy that he gives us, we speak Lashon Hara. Right? We insult him right there. So he says, here's a gift, and we say, in your face. Right? He says, here's a gift, here's some clothes, here's money for clothes, and we buy something that's not appropriate. Here's some money for food, and we buy food that's not appropriate. Here's kosher food on your table, and we don't say a bracha. Whatever it is, there's all kinds of times that we insult Hashem, but he still gives to us. He doesn't. He's not insulted by the fact that we insult him. So, okay, so that's Hashem's quality. How am I going to achieve this? So I'm trying to think about this in my life. And then I had a 2-year-old who started from two, maybe even younger. He started off, he started to call me stupid before he could even say S. So he would say tupidy, but tupid, tupid. And I'm like, you can't even pronounce the word. And your parents are like, so then, okay, he was really mad at me. And I, in Long Beach, I was, you know, big hostess. I always had a full Shabbos table. I always set the table for the maximum quota. Sometimes I would invite, but I always would scoop up everybody from shul, whoever needed invitations, and we had a full table. So, and everybody's, oh, your food is a thing, you know, and I try to not have my ego connected to the food, but it's not the easiest thing. So every comment is like, hey, your food is a great thing. Thank you, such a great cook, blah, blah, blah. So he knew that food was a thing, right? I use food to give, and people like my food. So he was really mad at me one day, and he called this fist. He was like, not quite free. He's like, I hate your food! Right. So he gave me the worst insult he could. Right. And I had to turn away from him to not laugh in his face because it was so cute, but he was so mad. Right. So it wouldn't be nice to laugh in his face, but I was laughing. I was not insulted in the least, right? So but I took a snapshot right there in my mind. So this is what it's like to be insulted and not take insult. Right? He just insulted me in the worst way he could with all his strength and power. And it didn't bother me at all. That's what it feels like. I have to like capture this moment so I know what it's like to be insulted and not take insult. So I captured it and have tried to apply it to other situations when other people could be more insulting when it could feel insulting. And you want to make sure that you can just let it flow off and you don't have to be insulted by it. So it's just in terms of working with people, having the capacity. I'll tell you one.
It's different because you felt more powerful than him, so you were able to laugh it off.
It's correct, and yet I had the feeling.
You
so all I'm saying is, I'm trying to take the feeling and be able to apply it when my feelings are hurt, and say that's the way I should be feeling. That's the way I choose to be feeling. Let me see how I could get these two situations together: how I do feel and how I want to feel.
The easiest way not to be insulted is to just feel holier than thou, and you know.
Correct. Condescension works very nicely.
Right. That's not the goal.
Right, and it's not the goal. It is not. It could be a temporary step, but it's not a goal, right? So, absolutely. So that's why I liked the way that I felt. It wasn't a power move. It was just so. It was his opinion of my food mattered so little that it didn't. It didn't matter. It didn't hurt at all. I didn't have to even go into a power mode at all. There was zero condescension. It was just so cute. But he did his best to insult me, and I wasn't insulted. So this same kid, just for a quick story for him. It's a funny kid. So, yes.
Would you have felt the same if it was an adult, your own child?
Probably not. That's what I'm saying, is that I tried to capture the feeling. In raising my child, I tried to apply it to growing myself, right? So that I had the experience and I could try to apply the feeling later on in a more difficult situation, right? Just so I knew what it felt like to be insulted and not take insults, and now I could try to take that feeling to a different situation where I felt insulted and try to choose to not feel insulted.
Choose.
Yes, to choose it, because you can choose how you want to feel.
Or how you react.
Right. Exactly. You can make that choice. I'll just tell you this one quick story, but it's a little bit off topic. So I was trying to control the kitchen. Everybody's eating all the time, right? And mother's constantly feeding. I finally decided, I have to create a closed kitchen at some point. This is ridiculous. There has to be a time when dinner's over, and I can just put everybody to bed, and nobody can say snacks anymore. So, but I have lots of little kids, so I would announce, you know, like whatever it was. Supper's going to be over in 15 minutes, and the kitchen will be closed. Supper's going to be over in 10 minutes, and the kitchen will be closed. Everybody come finish, because supper's going to be over in 5 minutes, and the kitchen will then be closed. Okay, the kitchen's closed, it's bedtime. Right, so I did that every night, and it worked out very well. And if they would say, I'm hungry, I'd say, okay, I'll make you a big breakfast. Yeah, but the kitchen was closed. One night, I'm tucking him in, this Motzei Shabbos. And he's not quite free. And tucking him into bed, and he says, I'm hungry. So I said, I'll give you a really good breakfast. He said, no, I'm really hungry. And I realized I had a lot of guests for Sudash the sheep, and I did not make the announcements. And he said, I'm really hungry. So now I'm starting to feel like I didn't make the announcements. He's not hungry. And I'm starting to waver just a second in my mind, and then he says, I just want a baby pizza and a cucumber. That's what I had served, right? Because it's actually cheap. So now I'm starting to feel really guilty. Like, he's not even 3. I didn't make the announcements. He's asking for healthy food. I had tons of guests. I probably didn't pay attention to if he ate or not. He might actually be hungry. So he looked at me and said, just a baby. You cook up just a baby. I said, okay, I'll go get that for you. So he sat up in bed and said, I won! Oh my God. Totally played me. Yeah, it was impressive. He was good. He still is. He just texted me, 23. He just texted me the other day. He's from college. He just graduated, but like maybe 6 months ago. I used to, when they would put brown sugar on their cereal, I said, that's way too much. And I took back the placement of brown sugar. And I would ask him, how much do you want? One or two? And he would say, way too much. Right? Because I had already defined the quantity that they wanted as a way too much, so that's how much they wanted. So he texted me. He texted me that I just put way too much brown sugar on my oatmeal and there's nothing you can do about it. Right. So that's the point. You do have to launch them and the structure has to come from inside, right? So you can try like a lobster party. Now we just have lots of fun together. Okay, so in choosing, let's see if I didn't put these in the right order, so I want to do that. Let's see, okay. In choosing, so I want to give you a practical tool to grow yourself and to be able to choose the reaction that you want to have. This tool is called skip step two. Okay, step one, something frustrating happens. Step two, you get mad at it or upset. Step three, you take care of the problem. Right, so step one, you missed your flight, right? Step two, you get really mad at yourself for not leaving the house on time. And step three, you go figure out which flight you're taking next, right? So you could skip step two. You don't have to get mad at yourself. You could sometime review your procedure leaving the house and why you were late or whatever it is, but you don't have to get mad at yourself. Same thing with a kid, right? Step one, there's milk on the table. Step two, there are carrots and they spilled it all over the floor and broke the glass, right? Really, step one is they break the glass and milk. Step two is you say, how many times do I have to tell you not to pour so much milk and not to put that glass on the edge of the table? Now go get a schmata and clean it up, or I'll go clean it up. Or go out of the kitchen, you have bare feet, I'll clean it up, right? So you could just clean up the milk. So it's your option how you will respond. Step two is always your choice. Step one is not your choice. Step three is solving the problem, but step two is always your choice. Do you want to get mad? Do you want to be right? Do you want to yell at somebody? Do you want to shame or blame? You might want to do all that stuff, but you could choose if you're going to do that or not, towards yourself and towards others. So I try to sometimes say things to myself like, I already have a broken plate. I don't also need a broken relationship, right? So I'll just clean up the plate. Right, it happened to Pesach. I have nice china for Pesach, nicer than my year-round china. The table was all set, and I had 25 people, and somebody quickly turned around and knocked the top plate off, and it broke on the floor, and the kids all looked at me because they know that I bought my Pesach china, and they were really hard to get it, right? And they're like, I'm like, it's great, we can start the Seder with a skip step two moment. And everybody looked at me and said, skip step two, what's that? So step one, the plate breaks. Step two, we get upset about it. Step three, we replace the plate and continue with the Seder. Let's just go straight to step three. And everybody's like, okay. I'm not quite sure what my kids knew what I was doing. So we just skipped step two and went straight to step three. It's a great mantra to have, to just remind yourself when you're in step two. And you'll notice other people who are in step two. You can't always tell it to them. But for sure, in your household, you can educate children and self, and possibly even spouse, to skip step two. And then you can notice the step two moments and just skip over them. It doesn't mean you don't have some feelings of frustration or anger or sadness. You can acknowledge them and release them or acknowledge them and deal with them later, but you don't have to deal with them by berating or blaming or shaming self or others. You can skip that and go right into taking care of it. So you might, while you're wiping up the milk, this wouldn't be step two to say, when you put the milk so close to the edge of the table, it spills more easily. Right? That's not blaming or shaming, that's educating. So that's a second little mantra I had for myself, besides skip step two, raising kids, was educate, don't berate. And I would try to put that in my mouth before I say anything.
I think that such a powerful thing that comes from that is that the children then really learn how to solve their problems. So instead of having a child that comes home and says, and this one's ABC and D, or they're speaking and they're so upset, they like automatically, when they see you as the mom doing that, I'm upset, I have a lot of work, this friend did this, can you help me solve my problem? Like, it kind of is also
right
for you, and for them, it's so healthy because it takes away all that night of crying.
Right, it takes, and you can even tell somebody. You're in step two, you're stuck in step two right now.
And they can do that. Like,
they can't.
From age eight.
Yeah, they can. They really can. It's so helpful. I came home from Israel, I bought myself a brand new carving knife, Chinese candle. You know, the kind that you use in Israel, which are not Israeli, they're Swiss. Right? So I brought home, I sent it to the mikvah, right? So I got back from the mikvah, I made a salad. Five hours later, I'm in the kitchen, I open the dishwasher, steam coming out, the milk of the dishwasher, and there is my brand new green handled knife in the milk of the dishwasher. So I take it out, I said, who put my brand new knife in the milk of the dishwasher? And the kids looked at me and said, Ina, skip step two. Right. That's right, so I'll just put it in the cash room pile, that's all.
Yeah, I have a question. So then, I think it's a great concept, but what if the kids feel like they're getting away with everything by skipping, always skipping over step two?
Doesn't mean you can't correct or educate. So that's where the educate don't
get right. Later on, you talk to them.
Yeah, later on. Yes, you're right. You don't have to be angry.
And think, oh, I can just get away with it.
You're skipping the useless parts. Right. But they can clean up. Right. They can clean up. You can say you spilled the milk.
Right. Now, because you said before, you go clean it up.
It could be you go clean it up. It depends on the state, right? It can be your teenager. It can be your teenager borrowed the car to go buy ice cream at night after you went to sleep. And in the morning, you get up and see a dent. They didn't ask. They didn't tell you. Right? So now you can storm into the house and start screaming about denting the car, or you can just say, you know, Moishi, I noticed that the car is dented. How will you be taking care of that? You know, it's going to need to go to the shop, and it's going to, you know, if you want, we can sit down and figure it out together. You know, but here's the number of the insurance company. First, let him say, I don't know. Or, I need to call insurance. Or, whatever it is. But you can empower him, depending on the level and where he is. Yeah, let him come up with a solution and work on it. But you don't have to scream out, he knows he should have dented the car. Right? So, but you don't have to blame and shame. Bad enough the car said, you need to also yell at the kid. Then you damage your relationship and the car. Just deal with the car and deal with the kid and the issue and let him take care of it. That's okay. It's not he gets away with it, but you don't have to go into a whole emotional rant about it.
I just want to say, it sounds like this is a very wonderful method to also make sure that your kids are comfortable talking to you about anything, because then they're not terrified of your response.
Right.
I mean, if there's something that they did wrong, if there is a mistake that they made, no matter how old they are, they're going to feel comfortable coming.
Yeah, you'll be safe.
Because they know you.
It's vital. I think it's probably one of my most powerful parenting tools, life tools. It's so helpful because you can practice on little things and it can help you with bigger things too. Right? God forbid there's a bad diagnosis. You don't have to have a meltdown about it. Right? It can help you in your immunity building, right? You can say, okay, this is really hard. How am I going to get through this? How am I going to handle this? I'm going to have to learn more about it. I'm going to have to strengthen my immune. I'm going to have to dump. I'm going to join a hollow circle. I'm going to have to, like, whatever it is. There's things I have to do here. But, and maybe I'm sad. Maybe I'm worried. But you don't have to, like, you can realize, okay, I'm in step two. Right? As somebody was driving me to the airport, it was Arab and Kipper. And they were taking me to the airport. And we're stuck in traffic. Right? And she's like, I don't know what we're going to do. And I was calm for that. She said, so it wasn't Arab. It was Arab speech recording paper, right? That's my paper from Mexico. She's like, I don't know what we're going to do. She said, I didn't realize there was going to be so much traffic. You know, this is really nuts. You might miss your flight. And I'm like, yeah, I might. She's like, but I really feel terrible. You might actually miss your flight. And then I'm going to get back with Mexico and Brooklyn and these speeches and Arab paper. And I was like, I'm looking at step two. Like, and why should I worry now? We're not even at the airport. Like, I should pre-worry about if we're not going to get there on time. Like, I'm just going to, whatever's going to happen, I have learned now how to deal with it in the moment. So I'm not going to be upset about it. So here, she had heard me talk about skip step two. I said, don't start up with step two before step one even happens. Right? So there's traffic. First, let's see when we get to the airport. And if we miss the flight, I'll figure it out. Right? There'll be another flight. Worst comes to worst, it'll cost some money. But I'll be able to leave within a few hours. So like, that's the worst that's going to happen. It's going to cost money and it'll take a little extra time. And maybe it won't. So we don't have to be busy in that. Like, let's just enjoy our conversation for the next half hour that we have so I can travel. So it's really helpful as an exercise to maintain calm and be in relationships and not damage them because of worries that you have or things that happen. So, yeah. Yeah.
I'm just going to share sort of from a personal level. So I did get the worst diagnosis when my son was diagnosed with leukemia. Been good, not talking about it, but late, especially, you know, I'm feeling comfortable talking with the women here. So this was 10 years ago, and again, I don't know where I got these skills, maybe my training as a speech therapist and work with children. So immediately upon diagnosis, he was admitted to the hospital. And I remember thinking, okay, use my skills, which is, you know, teaching children, age appropriate. I gave the example of Thomas the Train, and I drew a picture. I drew a picture of the train going in with black coal and then coming through a tunnel with red on top, because the leukemia is blood cancer, so. And then giving him choices, okay, and I learned this from the nurses, you know, thank goodness Joe DiMaggio Hospital, the nurses, you know, whether it was, all right, access your cord and which band-aid do you want. Mm-hmm. So here I learned about everything from child development and my speech therapist, but learning from others, you know, following their example, giving a three-year-old choices that, you know, the cancer is happening to him, but you know, he was caught, again, all the focus he got, and he's in an adult world with this heavy diagnosis, and I just watched how the child life specialist, you know, and this is what I'm using in my therapy today, when I deal with children with autism, or, you know, and giving, you know, his dignity and mm-hmm. giving choices, and I just wanted to share sure. that, because I took it proactively. I was proactive in his healing, in his treatment, and then my son became proactive, so much so this is why I'm here today, because he became, as a result, religious on his own, because God healed him, and he is amazing. He wants to be a rabbi and a psychologist.
He should do tons of masters.
So people told me I should write a book or talk about it, well, I just did. Children are amazing. They're smarter than we think, and just listen to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Share feelings, and he always, you know, he can only have one adult in the every once a month. He had to have a spinal tap chemo right at the base of the spine, so he wouldn't die basically. So it wouldn't go up to his brain. And the one parent, my husband was the good time Charlie, and you know, but he always wanted mommy in there, helping him camp, you know, get calm, mantras, you know, whatever.
I don't know what so techniques, right? So
techniques that we all have in us. I'm telling you, and when you needed that at that moment, it's there. And he always went into, you know, the sleeping medicine, put him down, and he always came out of surgeries. I was right next to him, you know, mother's touch.
Right, for sure. Right, so those are great examples. And actually don't actually have those tools just because they're there. Mm-hmm. You have to sharpen them.
Yeah,
right, so if you don't sharpen them, they won't
sharpen. You know,
right. So it's good that you gave them tools to sharpen them and develop them in yourself too.
He's,
right.
He's independent.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I also did those things kind of as a thing with my children, you know, not do you want to get dressed, because that wasn't the choice. But the choice is, you are getting dressed. Do you want to wear the red shirt? The blue shirt.
Yes.
So, right, so my kids got that.
The last 4-year-old said, don't try that first thing.
All right. So my 17-year-old picked up on it. Okay, let's move on to, let's see. Okay, I'm going to give you one more.
So, yes, on a much lighter note.
Yes.
Last week, I had 4 or 5 little boys sitting at my kitchen table, and my daughter had a friend, and they were all doing homework and doing things at the table, and they all had water. So, I heard, like, lots of water spill, and I didn't hear both my 5-year-old tell his friends, don't worry. And my daughter was saying, she doesn't care at all. I'm thinking in the kitchen, I don't know, like, No. It was great on one hand, and we're telling the kids, like, don't worry, she's not going to care about the water. But then I was like, I hope they don't keep spilling water. like, I'm saying, as an extreme, right. Like an extreme, like with that, like, right. I don't care about that. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying it's kind of funny. So when I heard all the water spilling, and the kids were like, she doesn't care. I'm like, okay, but if like more water keeps spilling on her, so we can't care.
Right. So these are discussions you can have with your children, for sure.
It was just like a funny exaggeration.
It's great. Okay, so here's another thought that I just want to share with you in terms of growing ourselves and working with our children. And that is my concept of Swiss cheese people. Right? So Swiss cheese. It has holes. Not the holiness, but the holes. The holes are there by design. They're there on purpose. Right? We were also created with holes by design. On purpose. Hashem made us holy people. Right? He made us with a lot of holes. Because he made us to be co-creators. He created us B'Tselem Elokim. Part of the Tzelem of Elohim is that Hashem creates humans. And so if we're created in Hashem's image, we also have to be able to create humans so we can co-create ourselves. So Hashem starts us off and we get to finish the job, right? So he had to create us with holes. So each one of those holes really is an invitation. Come create with me, right? So that's our own holes. So we don't have to feel as frustrated about our frustrating parts that are holes in us, because they're all invitations, if we could see them as invitations, and also our children, and also even our husbands, and even our mother-in-laws. We're created in the image of God with holes that are there as invitations, right? They're all there for us to grow and to be an invitation for each one of us to enter into that co-creator status with Hashem. So they're all opportunities. And we can start seeing them as opportunities instead of such frustrating things. Maybe they're frustrating opportunities, but to see them as opportunities and invitations rather than as limitations and frustrations, it shifts the whole thing and really can elevate the whole process of, okay, this is how Hashem made me. This is how Hashem made him. This is how Hashem made you, if you're the mom talking to the kid. Let's see how we can work together to fill in that space. Right? Hashem made you just like this. You're a little dyslexic, a lot dyslexic, a lot ADD, whatever it is, you have an anger problem, you have a trusting problem, whatever it is, let's work together to fill in some of those holes. Or you can educate as you work on yourself and set an example and work with the kids too, that everything has holes and that's normal and fine. And everybody's job is to work over a lifetime to fill them in layer by layer by layer. Sometimes new holes open up, new opportunities to grow, right? But if you really see them as opportunities to grow, they are still frustrating, and they're opportunities for growth. So if you recognize that we have holes by design, we're Swiss cheese people, then we have the opportunity to grow. While we're in the cheese mode, I was born in Wisconsin. I'll give you one more cheese muscle that I really like. It's really also off topic, but it's very helpful for this, because it really helps us. Well, maybe it's not. I'll blend it in with the topic. So it really is what our kids should know and what we must know about who we are as a people. Okay, so let's imagine we're in a cheese factory, right? So how do you make cheese? You need milk and what?
Mold.
Mold to flavor it. You need rennet to congeal it, right? Rennet. You need a coagulating agent, right? The traditional coagulating agent for milk is rennet. As Jews, we're careful about the rennet that we use, and most of our cheese rennet, those are enzymes instead of animal rennet. They use the stomach lining from calves that makes milk into cheese inside their stomach. That's what they use to make milk into cheese outside the calf's stomach. But that, for us, can be eaten milk, so we're not into that. So we usually do the vegetable enzymes or some of those other processes. But the point is, how much rennet do you need? We're in a cheese factory. This is a vat of milk, right? This size room filled with milk to make cheese. How much rennet do we need to make all this milk into cheese? Very good. Okay. Yeah, not much at all. I don't know what we need. For a room this size, a quarter cup? Not much. Very little. You can't tell at all. Compared to the mass of the milk, it's less than Buttel the Elf, right? It's not noticeable statistically the amount that you need. Right? Jews are the rennet in the cheese of the world. Right? We're the ones that make all the difference. We're statistically unnoticeable. But drop us into humanity and we change everything. That's who we are as a people. And that's what we want to do, is be able to change ourselves and change the world. Empower our children into that level of independence. But I would put under healthy is in their spiritual relationship to understand how powerful they are. They are rennet in the cheese of the world, a transformative agent, a catalyst for change and transformation in the world. That's who we are. That's what we can be. It's not just about our small selves, our small family. It's about expanding ourselves and flowing into our family, and our family flowing into the community, and the community flowing into the world, and creating a whole transformation through our empowerment. That's really what we're about. In raising ourselves, through raising our children, growing ourselves, through raising our children. And so we want to create an expansion that actually flows to touch the entire world. Right? And not just the world that we're living in now, but it actually touches the world back and forwards, done properly. That's what we're trying to accomplish, trying to inspire ourselves, to educate ourselves, so that we have that emotional and intellectual and spiritual and physical health to be able to grow and expand and empower ourselves and empower those in our environment so that we can achieve tremendous spiritual heights. Okay, I think I should probably end on that. So we'll just say that the way to do that, I have other things, but please. So we'll just say that, we'll remind us back to the beginning that Gadol HaMetzuva, if we want to become that expanded, the way to do it is step into Torah Mitzvot. That's it. It's the pathways, the physical paths to walk to accomplish the spiritual growth that we want. The greater we want to be, the more we just tap into the code, then we can expand ourselves and expand our family, expand the whole world. And I guess question.
Is there a way to contact you as far as, you know, if you want to tap into certain books, or I'm always looking
sure.
for and do you have an email?
Yeah, my email is elizabulo@gmail.com.
Aliza what?
Aliza Bulo, AlizaBulo.
gmail.com
and my website is abidetotor.com. Everything's free and I have tons of audio, lots of articles. And you are welcome to listen to, contact. If I don't contact you back shortly, contact me back. Mm-hmm. Because I do often bite off more than I can actually chew. So just write back.
It seems like my husband is Peruzzo, even though it's really a husband's principle. But so basically, when something complicated happens with the kids or whatever, I tend to be like the complainer, like, well, I didn't choose to have this many kids or whatever, and then I don't, so I'm stuck in that boat. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could explain what the point is of the Muslim. Having as many children as we're supposed to have
is relative, of course. Each person is their own person, and should have as many children as they're supposed to have. So it doesn't mean that each person is supposed to go crazy and have way more children than they can possibly handle, and then think that they're doing God's will by drowning in, you know, so that, but however many kids you have now is the amount that you're supposed to have. Whether or not you should have more is a discussion that you should have with your husband and your rabbi, or your halachic advisor. That's a different topic.
Right.
But certainly having children is about, so pru uribu mulu ata'aretz, that's really what it is. It's that we're supposed to, we're supposed to fill the world with direction, right? We're a goy kadosh, malachic kohanim. So, well, actually all people are supposed to fill the world. That's a mitzvah given to all humanity. But it is about the exercise of growing and expanding and continuing. So a lot of people don't actually engage in the exercise. They just engage in having the kids. So that's just true. But it's not a revu.
Okay.
Revu, that's why we have this halachic concept that you're supposed to have a male and a female that are healthy enough to have a male and a female. We don't yet know if they will, so we don't want to, you know, if you want to fulfill the mitzvah, the question is, it's a mitzvah in the Torah, it's the first one, right? So how do you know you fulfilled it? You have a male and a female, but you have a male and a female. So you have pru, and then you have uruvu, right, to multiply. So that means each one has a male and a female. But so we try not to take chances. You might have a few extras just to make sure it's everything we have right there. Nevertheless, right, it has to do with the uruvu concept, right? Pru is not enough. Just having kids is not enough, but raising them so that they get it and they want to participate in the continuity of pru or revu, that's really the challenge, is that part of it, right? So bringing them to a place where they understand what their mission is, Jew or non-Jew, right? To emulate the tzelma, to enhance their tzelma, looking to emulate the creator of the world, to in their sphere, there's different pathways for Jews and non-Jews, but all people have the job of making themselves closer to Hashem. Right, the Jews have the job, but I have to take off. I'll turn over.